History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. By now, we should know they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it, to ask some questions, to take some time to listen. And the expectation is we're probably going to be amazed by what we hear. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often, as you know, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the last month, we've heard quite a bit about the 80th anniversary of D-Day, even a few episodes of this program devoted to that massive undertaking. But another battle that started just a week and a half later was pretty significant too. And that battle's 80th anniversary has been not just overshadowed, but really completely swallowed up. So we're going to honor some of those survivors today, and just as importantly, honor the more than 3,500 Americans whose lives were cut short in the Battle of Saipan, which was in its final week at this time 80 years ago. We've met quite a few veterans over the years who experienced that intense clash, and we won't have time to include all of their stories today, but you are going to hear the voices of five Marines who helped secure that strategic stronghold covering less than 50 square miles of volcanic land in the Pacific. This phenomenon of the Battle of Saipan being overshadowed by the invasion of Normandy is nothing new, as we'll hear mentioned more than once today, starting with the memories of Bill Crumpacker.
We were about 10 days out of Saipan when over the ship's radio it said the American troops have landed with British troops on the continent of Europe. So we knew that the landing had taken place in Europe, but that didn't have much to do with the Pacific War. But we landed June the 15th on Saipan.
And what did you encounter there?
It was just as bad as Tarawa. Now, Tarawa was small arms fire. When we came in from the reef, it was machine gun fire, and I'm sure a lot of rifle fire, and so on and so forth. June 15 of 44, when we landed on Saipan, the artillery fire was unbelievable. I've read where they had 40-some pieces of artillery behind the ridges. Now, Japan was given Saipan and Tinian after World War I. They were our allies. So they had plotted every square yard of water and every square yard of land. I told people they could have hit a hula hoop on the beach there. Artillery fire so accurate. And I got ashore. My lieutenant was killed there. The lieutenant I had on Tarawa was wounded. I thought he had left for Valhalla, but he hadn't. But when I landed on that beach, the artillery fire was just terrific. Just terrific. And I decided that I better get off the beach and that maybe if Lady Luck was still with me, we'd see what happened. So I grabbed my rifle and I ran back, I would say, a couple hundred yards off the beach. And there was no Japanese soldiers there. They were behind the ridges pouring this artillery fire in on us. So I did get off the beach. But a lot of fellas did get killed there. And the artillery fire, as opposed to Tarawa, the artillery fire was just unbelievable.
Bill Crumpacker would make it through Saipan okay, but earn his Purple Heart in the next battle for Tinian. And all that artillery fire he mentioned on Saipan wasn't just coming from the enemy side. There were plenty of American shells flying through the air, including quite a few from the howitzer that young Jack Venables was assigned to. You might not believe just how young Jack was when he joined the Marine Corps, a story that goes back to before Pearl Harbor and his older brother's example.
My brother had joined the Marine Corps in June of 41. He was in the Marine Corps, and he was in the 8th Marines, and his outfit was the first off the West Coast. And they headed for Samoa because they thought the Japanese were going to attack Samoa as well. Anyway, it wasn't long before I was told by the recruiting sergeant that he would be able to put me in the same outfit that my brother was in. And I said, well, I'm not quite 17. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll tell you where you can use as a birthplace because the Hall of Records is burned down. They can't prove or disprove your age. So I went in at age 15, as did my brother. We were 13 months apart. I was the younger one of the two.
I've had other veterans tell me that they lied about their age or they got their parents to sign for them or this or that. But I haven't had anyone tell me that he was able to find a loophole of a small town in Texas where the Hall of Records had burnt down. I guess there's no way to count how many people did this, but it sounds like this was a fairly common thing with that particular Marine Corps recruiter, that he pointed people to fill it out this way and you'll get in?
I think so with young people, of course, younger than legal age for the military.
And what was that town in Texas?
Farwell. And it's interesting because when I was overseas and I was in a hospital due to malaria, it's a field hospital, it was in a tent actually, and some guy was yelling, hey Tex, hey Tex. And it was one of the corpsmen. I didn't realize he was calling me. And until I finally turned around and realized it was trying to get a hold of me. So anyway, it was kind of funny at the time.
So you'd never even set foot in Texas, and here you are listed that way. And what possessed you? I know your brother was in already, and obviously you guys had a great relationship, but 15 years old to want to go fight a war. Where did that come from?
Stupidity.
Had you known, huh?
Had I known. No, I'm kidding. I don't know why. I wanted to be with my brother. When they first started shelling us on Saipan, we weren't under the trees at the time. I was a gunner at the time, and I grabbed the gun sights, and the whole battery took off for the beach. We ended up in a 16-inch pit where the shell had hit, and it blew all the sand out of it. And the guys were lying that night, sleeping in that gun hole. And we could hear the firing. They were still fighting the Japanese during the night. And every once in a while, one of the spent bullets would hit the sand between one of us. And I couldn't believe it when I look back on it. No, not one of us got hit. But there was a captain in there. We didn't know this at the time, but he was drunk. And he yelled, follow me, and he climbed out of the hole. And he had his pack loaded with bottles of booze. And he was found the next day. He was dead. Very unfortunate. And I've told that story many times when I was in sales and working with people that I was trying to lead. I would tell them the story, and I would tell them, you know, we have a goal, and I don't want to be that captain.
When you say follow me, you want to make sure you're leading the right direction, huh?
Right, yeah. Yeah, they had Japanese firing at us as we ran across the airstrip. And then when we did get our guns all lined up and set up, we were getting shelled, and they had the trees right above our guns, or right next to our guns, I should say, and the trees were quite tall, and the shells would hit the trees, and of course shrapnel would fly all over that place. And we had, after we'd been there a while, we had dug a large, very large foxhole, and we'd put timber across the top of it. Anyway, it would handle our gun crew, so it was pretty big. And I was on the phones when we were being shelled very badly, and everybody dove into the foxhole, and I was the last to get in there. I yelled to the guys, I'm blind, I can't see, because the shell had burst just before I got into the hole, and I'd gotten the blast that hit my eyes. I didn't get hit with any shrapnel or anything. But anyway, I told the guys I couldn't see, and the guy said, well, open your eyes, and I did, and I could see.
Those few seconds, I'm sure, felt like a week or two to you, huh?
Yeah, it did. There's one thing about Saipan. That when we were coming to Saipan, they announced the invasion in Europe. It was June the 6th, and we thought, big deal. Here we are, it's June 15th, and we're going into battle. And nobody's talking about our battles. So we were kind of jealous until realized we found out later what a big deal it was in Europe. But we were kind of disappointed they didn't publicize our landings. And that landing, when I came ashore, there were a bunch of marine bodies lying on the shore. And one of them looked from the rear. His face was down in the sand, and it looked like my brother because he had a Japanese airplane band on his watch. And so did this guy. And I turned him over, and it wasn't my brother. And boy, was that a big relief because he'd already gone in. And we got together on Saipan. He came back from the front and visited. I was off someplace, saw him and a bunch of guys around him, and he had brought a bottle of sake back with him, and they were all drinking the sake. And I told Jim later, I said, that wasn't fair. I hardly got any. You guys had almost drunk it up by the time I got there.
Back home, neither one of you would have been old enough to drink.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. What I do recall was a last thrust of the Japanese military, and they hit our gun pits. We were behind this other battery of guns, and they were sticking their tank guns right into the gun pits and blasting away at our crew members. I think that was easy battery. I was an F battery, Fox battery, and one of the guys raced back to our battery and was telling us about it. And boy, his face was white as a sheet because he'd gotten out of the gun emplacement, and some of the guys didn't. So, and of course, we didn't know if they were going to come make it through there. Line of battle or not.
Again, that was Jack Venables. And that last bonsai charge on Saipan is something we heard about from another Marine. We're going to zoom back out a little bit to reset the big picture for you through the eyes of Ken Miller.
Ken was an apprentice carpenter before World War II, but after enlisting in the Marine Corps, he'd have to say goodbye to his young wife, Ruth, when he shipped out for the Pacific. And heading into Saipan in June of 1944, he received a letter informing him that he was a father. His daughter Karen had arrived, but he'd have to survive the war if he was ever going to meet her. Surviving Saipan would not be easy. After the Navy shelled the island intensely for days, about 70,000 American troops stormed its beaches, including a tall 22-year-old Marine named Ken Miller. The battle raged on for more than 3 weeks, and in the final days of that battle for Saipan, it turned into a very desperate situation for the Japanese, whose strength of 30,000 men had been reduced to about 3,000 or 4,000. You've heard many a veteran express on Hometown Heroes over the years an awareness that their enemy in the Pacific would fight to the death and even consider it a privilege to die for the emperor. On Saipan, Japanese General Yoshitsugu Saito called for a gyokusai, or bonsai charge. You've heard of those before. You know what that is. And here was the quote. Directly from the orders of General Saito, he said, "Whether we attack or whether we stay where we are, there is only death. However," he continued, "in death there is life. I will advance with you to deliver another blow to the American devils and leave my bones on Saipan as a fortress of the Pacific." Of course, those Japanese soldiers obeyed the order of General Saito, and here's what Leatherneck magazine had to say about it. For 10 harrowing hours, Sergeant Miller's howitzer battery was completely isolated from help as the screaming enemy overran the area. Early on in that 10-hour stretch, Ken was wounded in the leg, as you heard about. So, Ken, you're hurt. The enemy keeps coming and coming and coming. You've seen so many of your fellow Marines killed, and you want to help the ones who aren't killed but are wounded like you.
Trying to take care of them. Then as you go past them, they get wounded again because they're shooting at you and hitting them.
And they can't defend themselves. And you guys, from what I read, you had a pretty unique way of improvising some kind of shelter or protection.
Airplane parts, wood, the frames and stuff that they used. And we used it in terms of protecting them.
And even putting that together and stacking that on top of each other, you're probably getting shot at, right?
Yes. It was a day of misery.
Well, yeah, and I realize you can chuckle a little bit about it now and because you lived through it, but I just don't know that any of us can imagine what that's like. I mean, it's if you talk about staring death in the face, this is it, isn't it?
Death. You didn't think about anything else except saving the guys back there.
We're talking about 10 hours or so that this lasted, but how long did it feel like?
20 years or lifetime.
You were hit, and you got the Purple Heart for that, but there had to be some others that came pretty close to hitting you again. What were some of the other moments where it almost got you?
It happens so fast. You can't, there's no way in the world you can, if somebody said, how many times did you get hit or whatever, you're not even thinking about that. You just, I'm still breathing. I'm still trying whatever I can try to, in order to use whatever I can use in order to stay alive and keep my buddies alive, more important.
So you used all the ammunition you had, probably?
Yeah, I used Japanese, and used their weapons, anything I could do. You just keep moving and keep trying, thinking about the guys that's back there still need help, they need protection, and they need water.
And you need some help. Were you starting to think that the help was never going to come?
But about, three or four o'clock in the afternoon, tanks came, American tanks, and we picked them up on the way back and forth, you know. That was the end of it. And I sort of lost my thinking there. I was sort of not conscious of what everything was happening for a couple of days. I did not go on the sick bay ships that they had. I stayed there, and somehow I just worked through the whole thing. And unbelievable, but, you know, you just wonder how you do it.
I'm wondering how you did it.
Moving about, I run into a Japanese tank between me and the boys in the sick bay there and what have you. You call it whatever you want.
This is still during that battle or is this afterwards?
No, this is during the battle. Yeah. And you go around, just around all kind of trees and stuff like that, you know, and to where as you don't think too much, no wham, and there's a tank. But the tank, with his barrel of his gun, but he didn't have any ammunition. And here I am.
So you were alone against the barrel of a tank. What did you think was going to happen?
In war, you never know what's going to happen. And when it presents itself, you got to be ready. You got to be ready. I made tracks through the, you know, people, and no firing, no nothing on his behalf.
I guess someone was looking out for you.
Eyes was pretty big on the other guy, too. It's not a one-way street.
No. Yeah, I could imagine both of your eyes got big. And, you know, you mentioned the American tank showing up. Do you think you'd be sitting here talking to me if those tanks hadn't shown up?
No, because it had something I had to give because it was too hot of a seat to be in.
Even with that, even with those tanks showing up, there were very few of you that actually survived. How many?
Well, I don't know, but it wasn't very many. They gave me four out of whatever on the line, and I was one of them. But God, he's got his ways, and you try to figure it out. You wear yourself out trying to figure it out. Just take what he gives you and go. And you don't want to think he's prejudiced or anything like that, but I did rely on that a lot. I looked up many times and said, thank you, Lord.
When did you realize how many of your outfit had not survived?
Oh, right away, because they were going on to the ships, medical, back to Hawaii and Pearl Harbor and places like that, needed all the medical they could get. One thing about it, there's no air force to speak of, no air support of the Japanese.
I imagine you've read some of the things about that battle on Saipan. You've read about what you and those other guys did and what you survived. Is it hard for you to believe, even all these years later, that you did make it through that? Because it seems like you beat some pretty significant odds.
It's unbelievable. How we got through that day, I don't know. But we did. Of course, we lost a lot of people, too.
The casualties on Saipan totaled more than 3,500 dead or missing, another 13,000-plus wounded, and we're going to hear from two more Purple Heart Marines before we're done today. 80 years ago this week, they were trying to heal from those wounds suffered in the Battle of Saipan. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode reflecting on the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Saipan, a significant strategic victory in the Pacific that came at a heavy cost but has been overshadowed over the years by what was happening in the European theater at the same time with the much more publicized invasion of Normandy. We've already heard from three men who were there on Saipan, and here come some more memories from another teenage Marine, Warren Smith.
I was excited and I was scared too. Anybody that says they aren't scared is not really telling the truth. So I do know one person, though, that when we got there, he didn't stay with the unit. He had to get up where the front lines was, and within a day, he was dead. You got to fight as a unit. You can't take off by yourself.
Yeah, and those are lessons that you learn the hard way sometimes, as it sounds like you did. Can you help us envision what you saw when you got there? And this is 1944, so you're still a teenager. And when you got to that beach, what was going on there? What did you see? What did you hear? What did you feel?
Well, I remember seeing one dead Marine. And the front, we was on the second to invaders. First drive went in an hour ahead of us. So there wasn't a whole lot of action when we got in there. But the next day we moved a little bit, not much. And there was, to show you how brave or daring those people are, there was one Japanese soldier that had hid in a little hole and covered himself up with palm trees and laid there in that hot sun all day long waiting to get out to kill somebody.
So that was quite an education, I imagine, for a 19-year-old Marine. Do you remember what it felt like at the end of that day after, well, now I've seen a little bit of it, I've tasted it, and do you remember what that felt like or what you might have been thinking?
No, just wondering when it would get over with. That was about all.
What was your specific role within your unit? What were you armed with, and what generally were you expected to try to do?
I was an assistant B.A.R.man, so I had to carry his ammunition and stay with him.
And when you say carry his ammunition, so he's got that BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, which is pretty heavy, but you're carrying, what, a couple bandoliers worth of ammunition?
Yeah, it's a big bandolier. It isn't two bandoliers. Yeah. It's just one big one with a lot of 20 rounds in it. But then after the first day, the lieutenant's runner disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. And so he selected me to be his runner. And one night, our own artillery made a mistake and was laying in on our lines, and we couldn't get communication back to him, to the headquarters.
So you're in a foxhole or something, and your own American artillery is coming right where you guys are camped out.
And so the lieutenant sent me back to headquarters in the dark to get him to stop the artillery. And it's dark, and you don't go running around through the lines very much in the dark. So I was pretty scared then, and I took off and was running and hollering as I went. So I wanted them to know I was coming through. Runner coming through, then I'd holler the password. And I fell down a couple times, skinned my knees, and then I went back up to the company, and the lieutenant says, "What are you doing here?" I says, "I come back up here." He says, "I thought you'd stay down there till daylight."
And you said, well, if I knew I could, I probably would have, huh?
Well, I didn't even think about that. I just thought they needed me.
You know, you lived it, and I'm sure you've told that story a couple times to your family, so it's not a big deal to you, but I'm just imagining being this teenager in that situation. Like you said, it's dark, and you mentioned the password, and that's, I think, an important point, because there was probably as much danger of you being killed by your own guys as the enemy, right?
Right, definitely. That was why I was hollering and let them know that somebody was coming through, and they knew the password. Now, that password was changed every day,
right,
so that the enemy couldn't get a hold of it.
What kinds of things were used as passwords? Do you have any examples maybe of what those might have been?
Something like the Lone Ranger, or just odd things like that. Something about baseball, or I can't remember of any of them that we used, but they had a lot of them.
Well, the Lone Ranger would have been pretty fitting for what you were doing there, running through the dark and falling down.
That was just the quickest thing I could think of right now.
And messages weren't the only thing that you had to carry. I know you weren't a medic, but I understand that you did have a situation where you were asked to carry a wounded Marine. What happened there?
The enemy cut in with anti-aircraft and exploding it over the top of us. That was a little herring, and one of our guys got hit bad. And, of course, I was selected because I was a runner to help carry him back out of there. I don't know whether he ever made it or not.
So this is, again, in the dark. You're trying to get some sleep or trying to get some rest, and all of a sudden, tell me what that looked like, what it sounded like.
You're not resting when they're shooting anti-aircraft at you. But, yeah, you're scared.
So these are air bursts over the top of your position?
But after a while, you know it's a danger, but the bad fear goes away. You know, you're scared, but you're not paralyzed by it.
What made that transition? What enabled you to not feel that fear?
It's like the first time you go into a football game. You're all excited. After you get in there, all the fear goes away. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away, but the danger, you just control it. That's all I can say.
Between the 2nd Marine Division, 4th Marine Division, and the 27th Infantry Division, there were more than 70,000 Americans fighting, a little more than 30,000 troops of the Japanese Imperial Army, on an island that doesn't quite cover 45 square miles in the Northern Mariana Islands. Saipan remains U.S. territory today, and if you visit there, you'll find a couple of sites that are on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. That would be Suicide Cliff and Bonsai Cliff, two spots where some of World War II's most tragic moments unfolded. As Americans were overpowering the Japanese forces on Saipan, there were a couple of motivating factors that led civilians, both Japanese and the native inhabitants of Saipan, the Chamorros, to jump off of those two cliffs to their deaths. You might remember there was Japanese propaganda telling the civilians about the horrible things American soldiers might do to them. Of course, that was not true. And there was also an imperial order from Emperor Hirohito telling civilians that their status in the afterlife would increase if they committed suicide there rather than be taken prisoner. It's really not pleasant to talk about, but it's one of the things that the Battle of Saipan is most remembered for. Strategically, Saipan was a very important victory for American forces. It enabled them to move within striking distance of mainland Japan. B-29s from Saipan and, of course, nearby Tinian were bombarding the Philippines and Japan not long after those islands were secured. Warren Smith was part of that effort to win that battle that lasted from June 15th to July 9th, 1944. You mentioned having to evacuate a wounded Marine. So the enemy's exploding artillery shells over your position. This guy is hit bad. He's bleeding all over. And you guys put him on a stretcher, and you had to get him out of there. Of course, the enemy's still firing. And what do you remember about the condition this wounded Marine was in?
He was pretty bad. I never really heard what happened to him, but he was in pretty bad shape. We was going back to medical station. All I can remember is starting carrying him down there. The rest of it I cannot recollect. That says whether we came back up to our unit or not, I don't know.
When you see something like that, and you're carrying him, you know, on the stretcher, so you're close enough to see what his condition is and what that's doing to him. And does that make you think, boy, what if this happens to me? This could happen to me?
That's right. You think, well, Ben, that could have been me.
What about the day-to-day conditions on Saipan, what kinds of things you were dealing with, what the enemy was like? What do you remember about that?
Our condition wasn't all that bad. We were short of water for a couple of days, and all we got a canteen probably a day. And you'd pour your water in the canteen lid and sip that down, try to make it last. And then the water tasted terrible. It tested like sulfur water that you find different places in the country here now.
It doesn't sound like a very pleasant place to be. What do you think enabled you to keep going and to not just get down and miserable and scared and paralyzed by that fear and desperation?
That's something that I don't know. It's a job that has to be done, and everybody else is doing it with you.
Well, that's what I wondered, if that was part of it, if there was some strength in numbers or knowing that the guy next to you is going through the same thing.
I'm sure that's part of it, yes.
And you said that when that battle started, you were thinking, when's this going to be over? How am I going to get out of here? I know it didn't end the way for you that you wanted it to, but when you spent day after day in those conditions, you know, sleeping outdoors in this, you know, tropical island, did it seem like it was going to last forever? Did you have any expectation that it was getting close to over?
I can't remember of even thinking about when it would be over, really. I'd just be glad when it is over. And as far as our conditions, we C rations, they weren't too bad, or K rations. And they brought up hot food once in a while. So it wasn't bad like some of them did in the Guadalcanal when they were short of food and had a hard time getting them in there.
What was your impression of the guys that you were fighting against, of what the enemy was like and what you had to be prepared for?
I don't know whether I had any feeling about them or not. I just know that they was the enemy and they were doing what they'd been told to do. That is all I can say about them. I said, if you shot at somebody, there other people was shooting at him too, so you don't know whether you hit him or other people hit him.
Yeah, I guess that's the hard thing for us who haven't been in those combat situations to understand how chaotic it is.
Police officers, that is bad for them. That is bad after they have to shoot somebody. I can't imagine what they go through.
But because of the situation you were in, you felt it was a little different?
Well, yeah, they were our enemy. They were a different situation, you know. And you had to hunt them out. They would throw a grenade at you. They would kill themselves before they would let you capture them. Yeah. Most of them did. We captured a few. Mm-hmm. But I went through one cave after the island was secure months afterwards, and there was a cave in there. There was probably 100 people that had killed themselves with their rifles, tie a string to their toe and stick it in their mouth.
I'm sure you saw a lot of things that that you'd never seen before and maybe have never seen since. How long was it until you were wounded? Because this was the battle where they got a piece of you, right?
We landed June the 15th, and I was evacuated on July the 8th.
Tell me about that. What happened? How were you hurt?
Well, we had pushed them out into the ocean, and there was some trying to escape, and there was a group of civilians here. And there was one old soldier that somebody had shot, and somebody got wounded, so I was guarding till they got him out of there. And I got hit in the leg, whether it was enemy fire or our own fire, I don't know. Everybody was firing. That's about all I can say.
So you got hit in the leg. Did you feel pain, or was it just...
More like somebody hits you and gives you a Charlie horse, and I grabbed it like that. And there was a kind of a knot there like you can get. And then I looked at my hand, and there was blood on it. And so somebody hollered for a medic, and he started doctoring the front of my leg. And I said, I'm hit back here. Well, the thing had went clear through, and I hadn't noticed that, you know.
Wow.
Didn't break no bones. It went through between the bones. Mm-hmm. So I didn't suffer any real damage.
Is that something that you look back on and you're thankful because it could have been a lot worse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have no ill effects of it today. Never did have.
Something we can all be thankful for. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, another Marine wounded in the Battle of Saipan, where he also earned the Silver Star. We're marking the 80th anniversary of that victory in the Pacific, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Saipan. The fifth and final Marine we're going to hear from today, Bob Andre, was another teenager coming ashore that small volcanic outpost in the Pacific.
Second wave, which is the worst wave, because the first wave, they don't know where you're coming in. The second wave, now they know. They moved all the big guns over to where we're coming in.
And this same role that you have in a machine gun squad?
No, I was number four then, but before the battle I was over, I was number one. You lose them as you go along. Yeah.
So walk me through that. What did you experience as you came ashore on Saipan?
Well, when we first came ashore, we were nice area. We were able to see out some field we were going to go through, a nice field, easy, not too high grass, but no trees or anything like that. And our captain was out in front of us telling us, come, charge, come, calling us. And next thing we knew, he was killed. He was shot dead, yeah. Then the first lieutenant took over, and he was smarter. He stayed back further with the group, and he led us till we got up to where we were staying for the night. Then we settled down. The next day, we kept on going. We stayed on the front line for 15 days, I think it was, with not constant fighting, about every other day or something like that. And but we kept losing guys, you know, and finally, we went up to, we were chasing the Japs to the end of the island where Suicide Cliff was. You probably heard of that, where yeah. The women threw the babies over the cliff and yeah. All that.
We were because right. They were told this lie, really, this propaganda, what you guys would do to them.
Right, absolutely. And so we were stopped because we didn't want to kill any more. There were women and children up there. And so we were pulled back. On the 15th day, I think it was, we were pulled back to Garapan, a little town there. And for relief, we were taken off the line. And we bedded down on the beach. And first thing in the morning when we got up, there was a bunch of Army trucks out there, which they weren't ours. And they told us to load up. We're taking us back on the line. They said the Japs broke the last bonsai attack. They broke through the Army, ran over the Army, and we were put in second line as reserves. Don't shoot in front of you because the Army is there. Anyway, I was on guard duty that night from midnight until time to get up, 6 o'clock or something like that. And I'm sitting on in my feet in a foxhole, my back against a tree, with my pistol laying on my lap. I had a .45 at that time. My pistol was laying on my lap. Nothing was going on. All of a sudden, I looked, all these guys are coming at me. And I couldn't see them, so I knelt down. I'm looking, and they were close enough I could see they were Japs. So I start hollering, there were chaps, chaps, and I start firing. Well, I only had 8 shots. I always put one in the chamber, then I put the clip in, which is 7. And so first thing I start doing is start shooting at them because they were closer than she is, and just shooting at them, you know, all around. And I ran out of ammo, and the guy coming at me, he was with a bayonet rifle. He didn't shoot, so I figured after that he was out of ammunition too. So I jumped up when he was coming at me with that bayonet. I just threw my pistol at him, and it hit him someplace. And then I jumped up and grabbed the rifle, just like I did later, years later.
Yeah.
I grabbed the rifle, so we wrestled. Now, one of the guys in the foxhole put his carbine up underneath the guy's, the Jap's, area here and just unloaded the rifle, the carbine. And the others, what was left, retreated. But we were on the top of a hill like that. And when I was fighting with that guy, he was on right on the crest. They start going down. Well, then all the ones that were left, couldn't see him. So I got back down the foxhole. And I didn't have my machine gun at the time. I'd lost it in a fight earlier. Anyway, I walked over to their 2 first lieutenants. One was an acting captain, the other was his executive officer. And I told him, if I had my machine gun, I could have got most of them. Now I'm 18 years old. I think I know what I'm doing. Anyway, just then, I heard a guy hollering, help, help, help. So I just jumped up, and I didn't know why, but I ran out there to help him. The guy was holding this guy that fell back in his arm when he got shot. He was already dead, and the other guy was standing holding him. Well, I ran around to pick up his feet, and he got shot, and he went down, so I went down too. And I crawled around to him to see if I could help him. As I said, the other guy was dead. So I just started dragging him, and I didn't get shot. I got a hand grenade in my leg, shrapnel in my leg, yeah. That ended me. That was the end of my war experience right there.
So I'm guessing that I know you're a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Those both come in that one action right there that you're talking about?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I got the hand grenade.
Yeah.
So that was the Purple Heart.
And you were risking your own life to try to save another, thus the Silver Star.
That's what it amounts to.
Yeah. Let's fill in some blanks, though. Right before that, you're saying if I had had my machine gun, I could have taken them out. So that situation where you're on guard duty and your pistol's on your lap and you see all these Japanese running towards you in the dark.
Yeah.
How badly were you guys outnumbered there?
Well, at that particular time, I have no idea, but all I know, there was a lot of them coming.
And you unload every round that you have.
I only had 8. Yeah. I did have time to reload.
And then it's hand-to-hand combat. I mean, it's you or him.
Yeah, that's what happened there, yeah.
Had you ever, I'm sure you trained for that a little bit, but...
No. Oh, yeah, we had bayonet training and all that kind of stuff.
Does your adrenaline start pumping a little bit?
That's why I think I went out there. I was already, I had that going and I didn't know it. After thinking about it often, why did I do such a stupid thing? Because I could see the Japs out there, all of them shooting at us. Mm-hmm. And I ran right into it. We were told not to do that.
But it sounds like you didn't hesitate.
Well, evidently not, no.
And you weren't scared during any of this?
I don't remember being scared. I was too busy doing something.
So you go to help this guy. The other guy that he was trying to help is dead.
Yeah.
Then he's wounded. And as you're trying to drag him away, what happened? You hear a noise? You feel something? What stopped you?
Well, I felt that piece of metal go into my leg, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I looked down, your body has a lot of pressure, blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And it was shooting like crazy. I mean, up high out of the leg, you know.
So you feel something hit your leg, you look down, and blood is squirting out of there like being shot from a gun.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you starting to get scared yet then?
No. I don't remember ever getting scared.
Wow.
Ever. That doesn't mean that I was brave or anything like that. It was just I think I was out of my mind, to tell you the truth.
The adrenaline and the intensity of the situation had taken over?
Yeah. And if I had my machine gun, and you talk about it, it's on guard duty, my machine gun would have been in the foxhole where these other 2 guys were, because we have 3 in there.
Did I ask you how you lost it?
It was during another fight. Bullet took it out.
So it wasn't functional anymore?
No.
It wasn't like you misplaced it. They knocked it out.
I didn't misplace it, no. I couldn't use it, so they just kept it back in where we were R&R, supposedly. Supposedly 1 hour or 1 night. Yeah.
I guess that's a question, too, and not to bounce around here, but you said 15 days of combat there on Saipan.
Yeah.
Did you guys have enough to eat, to drink?
Yeah. Had all the food we wanted. Always sea rations, little cans like that. Tastes terrible.
You guys were aware of what was happening with that suicide cliff and what the Japanese were telling them?
I didn't have any idea about that. All I knew is that we were stopped because there was women and kids up there.
You'd learn more about that later, I guess.
Yeah.
So the hand grenade hits, goes into your leg, you're squirting blood everywhere.
I dragged that guy back to a foxhole, first one I ran into, put him in there, and the corpsman came over to start taking care of him because they could see me, but they couldn't see him. They were still shooting at me. So I crawled looking for another hole, going over that road, over the hill, trying to get away from their sight.
You had to be losing a lot of blood.
Well, yeah, but the corpsman came back to me, and he used my medical pack, put it on there, and then wrapped it around the leg to stop the bleeding. But it didn't stop it because pressure was so high that the blood was washing away the medicine that he put on there, and it went right through the padding he put on there. It went right through it, and still squirting up. Yeah.
And you were still conscious?
Yeah, I was conscious all the time.
Were you in pain?
If I was, I didn't know it. I really don't remember any pain.
So what did they finally have to do to stop the bleeding and save your life?
Well, put a new Band-Aid on until it finally stopped, yeah.
I know you've told this story before, and you tell it like it's no big deal.
Well, I can't help it. That's the way it was to me at the time, yeah.
But I hope you understand that for the rest of us, we're saying, how in the world did that guy do that?
Like I said a moment ago, it was either out of my head or something.
And when did it start to sink in, the condition that you were in? And how would you describe that condition?
I don't remember what it did, to tell you the truth. All I know is that I was out of the war. The Jeep came up there, and they loaded me on a Jeep with a couple other wounded guys, and had a second lieutenant ride as guard on the Jeep and took it down to the field hospital. Then they looked at me, the doctor did. They triaged me there, and they said, send him out to the hospital ship. They couldn't operate on me there. So they sent me out to the hospital ship, and I stayed there about 3 or 4 or 5 days, I guess, before they finally got around to operating on me.
And what did they have to do to fix you up?
Oh, it cut a big hole in my leg. It was about this big.
So you're about, six inches in diameter?
Yeah, big. It went down like a V, and the metal had hit the bone, the main bone. That's where he found it. And so when I was in New Caledonia in the hospital, they'd come in every day and change the bandage and put Vaseline gauze in there. They'd go down to the bone and they'd start wrapping it around because all the skin from here down to the bone was chewed up by that shrapnel.
Wow. So this took a lot of your flesh,
but
did not damage your bone structure.
No, it didn't hurt. Had it done it, I would have been in a damn cast up to the whole body, you know.
Was there some pain at some point?
If there was, I don't remember. I really mean it. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't remember. I didn't dwell on it anyway. Kind of like now.
But as you're sitting there on the hospital ship or the field hospital or later on, you probably had a lot of time to think about a lot of things. What kind of stuff went through your mind?
Girls.
They're nice to the guy in the hospital bed?
The nurses weren't nice to privates. They were always with the officers. They could talk to us. I'm joking. You know that. Okay. No, they treated me great. Most of them were men aboard the hospital ship. And the hospital, field hospital in New Caledonia, they were all RNs. But there had so many wounded that they didn't pay much attention to us. As far as the Silver Star, I met another one of the guys that was in my outfit, and he had told me that they put me in for the Silver Star, but they put a lot of people in for medals. In Washington, they're the ones who decide. In the Marine Corps, officers don't decide. And it has to be verified by an officer. It happened to be there were two officers I was talking to when I went out there. And he told me about it. I forgot all about it. After a while, many months, I was finally discharged from the Marines, went home. I was home maybe 8 months or so, and I got a call that they're awarding me the Silver Star, and they want to put a parade on in Treasure Island, San Francisco Bay, and award me the Silver Star. I sent them a letter back and told them, just send me the star. I can't take time off from work. So I got it through the mail. I didn't get the parade.
Sounds like you weren't looking for the attention.
I guess so. I've told you more than I should, I guess.
No, you didn't. And I've talked to so many guys. And my grandfather received a Silver Star for pulling 26 guys out of burning tanks in Europe.
Did he really?
And he didn't talk about it either. And one of his reasons was he knew how many guys didn't come home. Was there a point in all of that for you where it sank in? How many of your friends didn't get to come home?
No. I did what I was told to do. And when I got out, I just worried about making a living, trying to make money.
How about the extent of your injury? Is that something that bothered you at all after the war?
Well, it did for a couple of years, you know, but because there was a lot of mass that had to fill up that hole. You know, it took quite a while to do that with tissue and stuff, yeah.
So were you weaker on that side, or you just deal with
just
pain?
Just the leg, yeah. But yeah, when I went to work for the telephone company, that was good because I was climbing telephone poles and stuff like that, was strengthening the leg up. Funny part about it, when I never ever thought myself being real young until I got out into the real life as a civilian, and then I see these kids and I think, my God, that young, I can't really believe I did some of the things I did, but I did.
And we can celebrate freedom in our 50 states and the U.S. territory of Saipan and the Northern Mariana Islands because they did. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today and this chance to shine a deserved light on the sacrifices made in the Pacific Theater at a time when the European theater dominated so many headlines. It was true then, and it's still true 80 years later. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.